Confused, she looked away again. They were passing a barge called the Travelling Museatorium, decorated with gaudy paintings of freaks and monsters. She thought how tawdry Bargetown must look to Dr. Teal, and how foolish he must think her, squandering her skills aboard a theatre. All the excuses she made to herself, her vision of herself as a scientific missionary spreading the light of reason among the fairground crowds, seemed foolish and threadbare now. She was no better, really, than an out-country technomancer, and she was sure that Dr. Teal must despise her. "I expect you're wondering what brings me to Maida at the world's end," he asked. She hadn't been, but he told her anyway, while they walked together along the harbourside. "I am on a mission for the Guild. The new London will be a city much like this, convex rather than concave, but a vertical city, a city of tiers. Quercus wants me to see how the Maidens manage it. In particular, he's intrigued by their moving houses. In the new London, the different levels will be linked by elevators, and the Guild believes we may have much to learn from these funiculars. I must make some drawings. I'll be sending regular reports back to London. If you have any messages for Dr. Crumb or Wavy Godshawk, just let me have them. I'm staying with London's representative here, a merchant called Hazel."
"Thank you," said Fever. "Perhaps you could let them know that I'm well."
"Only that? No word of when you might be coming home?"
Fever shook her head.
They reached the cafe that Dr. Teal had spoken of, sat down at a table under a fluttering umbrella. He ordered coffee for himself. Fever said truthfully that she had only just finished breakfast. "I slept late."
"You must have been late to bed. The play, and then the party afterward."
"I did not attend the party. I went for a walk on the cliffs, and..."
"You needed some time alone, I'm sure. It must be difficult to think cooped up in a clattering barge with that bunch of actors."
"It is, sometimes," agreed Fever, and felt as if she were betraying her friends. She had been about to tell Dr. Teal of the white glider that had come to her on the night wind. But his coffee arrived, and watching him thank the waitress and add cream and sugar to his cup, almost un-engineer-like things to do, she changed her mind. He would think even less of her if she started babbling about moonlit walks and flying machines. Instead, she said, "Are there men of reason in Maida? Scientists who might have some knowledge to share with the Order? I mean the Guild." Dr. Teal laughed softly.
"Hardly. You know how it is in these southern cities. They worship some nature goddess who forbids them from using technology. The downsizing casts a long shadow. Even now, all these millennia afterward, superstitious people still reckon that the ancients must have been punished for all the machines they built, and that anyone who tries to copy them will be punished too. If Maidens come across some scrap of old tech, they do not try to learn from it, like rational men. They hand it to the priests at the Temple of the Sea, and it is flung into a sacred tide pool to rust."
"But what about the funiculars? How are they driven?"
"Ah, simple weight and counterweight. Water-powered, and built to a design that hasn't changed in centuries." "No, Miss Crum, you'll find no scientific minds in Maida."
He sipped his coffee, arched an eyebrow.
"Not unless you count Thursday."
"Thursday?" said Fever. That was the word the angel had croaked at her in the moonlight on the cliff path. It had not occurred to her that it could be someone's name.
"Arlo Thursday," said Dr. Teal. "He's the grandson of Daniel Thursday, who was once the greatest shipbuilder in Maida. Arlo is the last of his line. Quite batty, by all accounts."
"Have you spoken to him?" asked Fever.
"I couldn't, even if I wanted to," Dr. Teal said carelessly. "He's a complete recluse. Lives all alone in his family's old funicular up at Casus Elevado, on the western wall. Sees no one, speaks to no one, just tinkers with his crazy contraptions."
He chuckled.
"They say that he's trying to fly."
Chapter 5. That Old-Time Religion. A small brown boy went running out along the arm of one of the ramshackle wooden cranes that lined the harbour side, and stepped off the end into empty air. Ruin paused in his work and shielded his eyes against the sun to watch as the boy went falling over and over until he vanished in a bright burst of spray between the moored boats. He surfaced quickly, sleek as a seal, laughing, waving at his friends on the dock. Already another boy was scaling the crane to take his turn. Ruin watched for just a moment more, feeling a little wistful. He would have liked to be like those boys, carefree and fearless, playing games in the sunlight that was now tilting into Midas Crater. But he had work to do. Usually, the afternoons were the time when the company performed comic sketches or AP recited poetry to bring a little extra money in and advertise the evening's performance. But during these few days in Midas, there were to be no such matinees. Instead, the Lyceum's crew was busy sprucing up their sets and costumes, which always began to look a bit tattered at this end of the season. So Ruin and Fergus were busy with paint and brushes, freshening up the shabby backcloths from Neil's strongarm, which had been spread out on the ground beside the barge. Up on stage, some of the actors were rehearsing an extra scene that AP had written, while Max slapped a fresh coat of silver paint onto Apollo's chariot. Ruin could see Fern watching from the wings. People on their way to visit the other barges kept stopping to watch too, but Fergus always waved them away, saying gruffly, "Come back later, just a rehearsal, come back at sundown, the show starts then." But not all the passers-by were watching the stage. Ruin kept finding that people were watching him. It made him feel proud and self-conscious and a little awkward, the way they pointed at his work and whispered to one another. They were admiring the way he'd used brisk dabs of white and black to give depth to the coat of arms he'd sketched in on the wall of the moon goddess's palace.
Move on," growled Fergus. "The boy can't work with you lot standing twixt him and the sun. Come back tonight, and you can see it finished."
But the onlookers weren't really in Ruin's light, and he quite liked them watching. He was starting to suspect that Fergus was just envious. Nobody stopped to point at the cloth Fergus was working on. The clouds and mountains he had done looked gaudy and unreal, and Ruin knew that he could have done them better, even though he was only 10. He finished the coat of arms and started work on the stones of the wall. A line of white along the upper edge of each and down one side. A line of grey, black along the bottom and up the other. A few cracks, black for the shadow, white for the lit edge. He added some moon ivy growing up the wall, green leaves with black shadows, a white highlight on each. He didn't know if there was really ivy on the moon, but it felt right to him. And when he paused and stood back, he saw that the dull old wall had come alive. It looked as if each of those painted stones and leaves was real. It would be better, he thought, if Fergus had let him use blue or purple instead of black. But Fergus hadn't liked that idea. Black was cheaper, and using other colours smacked of arty-fartiness.
"You always use black for shadows, boy," Fergus had said. "No one'll notice anyway, not from out in the audience. They'll be watching the actors, not your pretty painting."
Ruin started work on the garden. It had hedges trimmed into the shapes of fish and griffins and two stone nymphs. He amused himself by giving Fever's face to each of them. He was just finishing when a shadow fell across the canvas and AP was standing over him.
"Ruin, is Fever back yet?"
Ruin shook his head. AP sighed.
"Well, I'm sure she and Dr. Teal have much to talk about, but I need to talk to her myself before curtain up."
Ruin could not think of anything to say. He didn't like the way that Fever had gone off so eagerly with that London man, as if some baldy engineer meant more to her than Fern and him and all her friends. He wondered what they had been talking about all this time. Maybe Dr. Teal would persuade her to start shaving her hair off again. That thought sparked others more worrying. Maybe he would want her to go back to London with him. Maybe he'd want to marry her, which would be a disaster, as Ruin had always imagined he would marry her himself as soon as he was old enough. He felt small and powerless, and intensely jealous. But he could not explain that to AP. AP peered at the backcloth and smiled.
"Well, this is splendid, Ruin. Keep up the good work. And when Fever comes back, please tell her that I need to..." "Fools! Blind fools! Spoiled children!"
someone bellowed, and Master Persimmon stopped, astonished to find his own voice drowned out by one even more thunderous. The actors on the stage stopped too, all looking to see what the disturbance was. An odd procession was winding its way between the parked barges, dressed in costumes as fanciful as anything that Alison Froy had ever run up. Flowing taffeta robes, stiff tabards, gold-embroidered copes, weird caps and headscarves, and all of it blue or green or blue-green. There were perhaps 20 people there, men, women and children, some banging drums and jingling rusty bells. They were led by a large elderly woman, and it was she who was doing the shouting, directing her words at all the barges and all the visitors who were milling around them. A few of the barge folk shouted back at her, but she ignored them. When she saw the Persimmon Company watching her, she wheeled and strode closer, pointing a sapphire-bejewelled forefinger at the Lyceum.
"Sinners against the sea! How dare you bring your trinkets and technologies to Maida to bewitch the young and ensnare the foolish? Do you not know that this is the island of our mother below? Do you not fear the wrath of she who once raised up the oceans to sweep away the cities of the ancients and cleanse the world of their corruption? Then you shall be made to fear her. The waves of her holy sea will swallow down all your workings, and her children, the fish, will devour you. Her sacred waters will wash away your sin-black carbon footprints."
She was just about to make a footprint of her own in the fresh paint on the edge of the cloth that Ruin had been working on, but Master Persimmon had recovered himself, and he stepped into her path, holding up a hand to halt her. They confronted each other. The actor-manager, in his dowdy rehearsal clothes, the priestess, in her extraordinary vestments. She was a big woman, and the wide-shouldered blue robes hung right to the ground, with her fierce red face poking out of the top so that she looked as if she was tucked up in a bed that someone had tipped on end. On her head, she wore a turquoise mitre shaped like the body of a squid, with the long tentacles draped down over her shoulders. Each sucker was a gold ring, and inside each was a little sunshiny silver mirror. All the other metal about her, the necklaces and pendants, the flying fish brooch on her gown, the settings of her sapphire rings, was rusted old iron, corroded and blessed by the sea.
"I am Ambrose Persimmon, and I am at your service, ma'am," said A.P., bowing low. "I am Orcar Moe," said the woman, "and I am not at yours. I serve only the goddess."
"Well, you and your goddess are very welcome here," replied Master Persimmon, with that charming smile that had melted the hearts of so many matinee audiences. "My company and I have travelled widely, and we have nothing but respect for the gods and goddesses of all lands. Yours is the sea goddess, I presume."
"There is no other," roared Orcamo. "All other so-called gods and goddesses are false. There is only the sea, and the goddess beneath it, the Mai Abajo, our mother below. All life came from her, and the lands of the earth are dry only by her grace. How dare you profane them with your machines, your barges and your engines and your filthy electricity?"
Technoclasts, thought Ruin. Machine breakers. Fever had told him about people like this, religious fanatics who believed that all machinery was evil and that the downsizing had been the gods' way of punishing the ancients for polluting the world with their technology. He set down his paintbrush and waited to see how A.P. would deal with them.
"My dear lady," said A.P., "we are but simple actors. Our engines and machines are only there to aid us as we bring pleasure to the masses. Perhaps if you were to come and see our play for yourself, you might feel more kindly disposed toward us. May I present you and your friends with some free tickets for tonight's performance?"
The priestess turned her back on him so quickly that the tentacles of her squid hat swung out around her head like the ribbons of a maypole.
"Listen to him!" she shouted at her followers. Listen to that honeyed voice that tries to tempt us from the ways of our mother below. Are we tempted to come and watch his sin-lit mummery? Would we throw away the love of the goddess to see him strut and mumble on a stage illumined by the wicked technologies of the old ones?
Mumble, cried Persimmon indignantly. But the priestess ignored him, and her followers were all too busy shouting, no, to hear. One little girl forgot to shout, being too busy staring at Fern. But when Fern waved at her, and she waved back, the girl's mother noticed and whacked her sharply across the back of the head with a tambourine. Orca Mo glared over her shoulder at A.P. and at Mistress Persimmon, who had come down off the stage to stand beside him.
The goddess does not want you here. If you try to perform, disaster will befall you. I warn you for your own good. Bow to the will of the Maya Bajo. Make sacrifice to her and pray that she will wash clean your inky souls.
Her followers all raised their flags and tambours, shouting, hear her, hear her. And through the midst of them came Fever Crumb. Despite the noise they were making, she did not really notice them till she was among them. She was thinking, and if she had heard the rattle of the sea worshippers' tambourines at all, she had dismissed it as just another of the sounds of Barge Town. Now, looking up, she found strange hats and fervent eyes all around her.
You, child, shouted Orca Mo, pointing at her. Do you too ride aboard this chariot of sin? Will you not pray with us and let the mother below into your heart?
Fever blinked at the priestess's perspiring face and flaky finery. Religious people disgusted her, and they seemed even more disgusting today, when she was fresh from talking about rational things with a rational man. The priestess beamed, taking Fever's silence for a sympathy. She had always found that the young were the easiest to convert. Their minds were so open. She laid one plump hand on Fever's shoulder and said,
kneel down. Pay your respects to the goddess.
Fever flinched backward, but found the faithful hemming her in behind. She felt herself blushing with anger and embarrassment. All right, she said. I'll kneel down and worship your goddess if you'll kneel down and worship my giant hen. Orca Mo was startled. For a moment she did not understand that Fever was making fun of her.
What giant hen? She asked.
This one here. Fever gestured to the empty space beside her. The priestess's face darkened.
There is no hen here.
Of course not, said Fever. I made her up. She's imaginary, so she's worthy of exactly as much respect as your goddess. She slid nimbly between two of the indignant sea worshippers and walked quickly toward the Lyceum, ignoring the shouts behind her, the rattling tambourines. Fergus and Ruin had overheard everything, and they were both grinning. Cosmo lightly was saying,
an invisible hen! Ha, ha, ha!
To the actors up on stage, who hadn't heard it for themselves. Fever felt rather pleased with herself. She would never have had the nerve to confront unreason in such a way 2 years ago. She wished Dr. Teal had been there to see her stand up for her disbelief. But Master Persimmon looked concerned as he came to greet her. The priestess and her fishy flock appeared to have given up the Lyceum's crew as irredeemable and were rattling away along the harbourside in search of fresh sinners to harangue. But he watched them worriedly as they went.
Really, Fever, that was not quite polite.
Nor was she, said Fever.
Even so, we have to respect other people's beliefs.
No, we don't. Not if the things they believe in are stupid.
I simply mean...
Not for the first time, Master Persimmon found himself feeling slightly helpless in the face of Fever's stubbornness. Not that he did not respect her for it. The more gods, the better, as far as he was concerned. But he knew that Fever was convinced that there were none at all, and he rather admired the way she stood up for herself.
An invisible hen, indeed.
He started to put a fatherly arm around her. then recalled that she disliked being touched, and scratched his ear instead.
"We are visitors in Maida," he reminded her, "and that was not diplomatic. But let's not worry. That insufferable woman has already caused us enough delay. Now, about the lighting in this new scene."
Chapter 6. The Shipwright's Curse. Dr. Teal had given Fever much to think about. Not just the news he had brought from London, but his talk of the inventor Thursday, who Fever felt sure must be responsible for the glider she had found. All the way from the quay where they had parted, she had been turning over in her mind the things he had said, wondering if she should have told him after all about the glider. Was it possible that here, in this irrational and superstitious city, someone had solved the mysteries of flight? But the irrationality and superstition of Orca Moe had distracted her, and afterward there was no time to think about anything but her work. Lamps had to be rearranged, bulbs checked, batteries charged, AP's new scene rehearsed and lit. Then a quick meal, and by the time the washing up was done, the sun was already dipping toward Lost America, and it was time for the performers to change into their stage clothes and for Fever to scramble down into her den beneath the stage. Sometimes, as the audience gathered outside, she found herself thinking of the glider, which lay like a fallen dream under the hammock in her cabin. But she pushed the thoughts away. She had work to do. After the visit from Orca Moe, AP was afraid that the sea worshippers might stage a protest. He had warned Max and Fergus to be on the lookout for troublemakers among the crowd, and he had written himself an extra speech in which Neil Strongarm described how, on his journey to the moon, he had looked down on Maida.
"Finest of cities, fair and fortress strong, set in that stony bowl whose noble walls her all-wise goddess raised from out the main as sea-girt havened to the maiden race."
A little flattery like that never went amiss, and there was warm applause when he spoke the lines. But Orca Moe and her followers were not there to hear them, and if the rest of the audience knew how Persimmon's technomancer had insulted the priestess, they did not let it spoil their enjoyment of the play. Maidens loved a spectacle, and word of the electric theatre had spread. They sighed at the love scenes between Strongarm and Celine. They gasped at the moon monster, a terrifying leather serpent that reared up and hissed when Max Froy worked a bellows off stage. And they adored Fern, for they were fond of children. When Celine's littlest handmaiden said, "Yes, my lady," they all clapped, which made her blush, which made them laugh and clap again, until, at Dimphna's prompting, she had to say the line once more. When the story was ended and the cast came on to take their curtain call, the applause rolled against the stage like surf. Beneath their feet, Fever lay back in her hot, stuffy lair and closed her eyes and let the image of the glider form again in her mind. The company dined that night at a taverna called the Curious Squid, not far away along the harbour side. They had been invited there by a wealthy maiden who had seen the play the night before and enjoyed it so much that he wanted to meet them all. Senor Belkin was his name.
"But just call me Fat Jorgo," he said, cheerfully patting his enormous stomach. "Everyone else does. I grew up a little barefoot, bony urchin on the harbour side. I always thought fatness was a sign of success."
"Then you must be ever so successful," said Fern, gawping up at the splendid acreage of Fat Jargo's embroidered waistcoat. He looked like a well-dressed planet.
There were other maidens at the table, too. Fat Jargo's beautiful wife, and another merchant, Senora Barcelo. They all wore sea blue somewhere about their persons, and Senora Belkin had a rusty brooch in the shape of a flying fish on the shoulder of her dress. But they were no friends of Orca Moe and her crazy followers.
"It is time that we Maidens shook off our mistrust of the old technologies," said Fat Jargo. "Orca Moe's brand of sea worship is only for the ignorant. Most of us Maidens nowadays believe we can be faithful to the mother below without turning our backs on all the pleasures and conveniences that the modern world has to offer. We are delighted you are here. We thoroughly enjoyed your performance, didn't we, Thurtsome, my dove?"
"Oh, yes,"
agreed his wife, smiling shyly, lifting her sea-green eyes for a moment to look around at all the company. She was very beautiful, with milky skin and thick, curly, dark red hair. When Feva looked at her, she felt a splinter of God's hawk stir deep down in her mind. Her grandfather had always had an eye for good-looking women. And good-looking men, too, come to that.
"Are you staying long, Persimmon?" asked Señor Barcelo, becoming businesslike over the starters.
"Just a few days, alas. Then we go south to the fiesta at Merriam. But it will only be for a week or so, and we shall call here again on the way back north. Then we shall come and see you again when you do," said fat Jago, glancing at his wife. "And we'll bring all our friends, won't we, Thatcher, my sweet?"
"I remember the last time you visited Maida," said Señor Barcelo. "Mistress Persimmon's performance as St. Kylie is with me still."
"Oh, but I was only a girl then," cried Laura Persimmon. "Of course, in those days we acted by candlelight. We did not have Feva Crumb to electrify us."
"Hear, hear,"
said fat Jago, raising his glass of blood-red Maiden wine.
"To the brilliant Feva Crumb, and the light that she has brought us. I hope that you will allow fat Jago Belkin to be your guide, Miss Crumb, to the many wonders of Maida. I have long admired the achievements of London's engineers, but until now I have never met one for myself."
Feva thanked him, feeling embarrassed. He really was immensely fat, and although he had shaved his head in a rational manner, he had spoiled the effect by painting a red diamond on the top of it. His clothes glittered with gold thread, and there were jewels on his fingers and in his earlobes. He did not seem like the sort of person who would even have heard of the Guild of Engineers, let alone admired them. But he was still smiling at her, and she felt that she had to say something, so she asked, "Have you heard of a man named Arlo Thursday?" Señora Belkin gave a little gasp. Her husband looked at Feva so warily that she added, "A colleague of mine spoke of him. He sounded interesting."
Señor Belkin snorted.
"That's good. Yes, interesting. That's a good word. The whole family was interesting, though demented might be a better one."
It was a little shocking to hear him speak so savagely. He had seemed so kindly and had talked very nicely to the children, congratulating Fern on her performance and Ruin on his painting. He saw the surprise on their faces now and said,
"You must understand, my dears, that the Thursday family has a strange reputation. People say they are..." "What is your word?"
"Witches."
"Witches?" asked Lilibet from farther down the table. The talk there was fading out as everyone turned to hear what the Maidens were telling Feva. Fat Jago laughed.
"Perhaps not actual witches, but nevertheless, there has always been something strange there."
He looked around at his fellow diners, his round red face filling with pleasure at the chance to entertain these entertainers. Nudging his wife, he said,
"You know the story, don't you, Thurzer, my dear?"
Thurzer Belkin had scarcely spoken until then. She had just sat there eating and drinking neatly, smiling pleasantly at other people's jokes, as if she were a mannequin on which her husband could display these diamond necklaces and earrings, this gold embroidered gown. "Arlo's grandfather was Daniel Thursday," she said. "He was a builder of fishing boats.
But one day a stranger came to Maida, a foreigner of some kind, a man named Asuara. He wanted a ship built. The mother alone knows why he went to Dan Thursday, instead of consulting one of the big shipyards like Milliards or Blazes," muttered fat Jago, topping up everybody's glasses.
"That was just the beginning," said his wife. "Daniel Thursday and the stranger became firm friends. After the stranger left, Daniel went on building ships, and they were better than anyone else's. Better than Blazes or Milliards or anyone's. They went like the wind. They cut through the sea like knives."
Señor Barcelo said, "Some people claim that this stranger was the devil himself, and that Dan Thursday had sold his soul in exchange for success."
Thursday grew rich and old, and his son took over the business, Signora Belkin went on, and it was more successful than ever. The other shipbuilders were jealous. They sent spies to try and pry into the Thursday's secrets, and even assassins to kill them, but none ever returned. It was said that the Thursdays had a familiar, a tame demon that killed anyone who threatened them. It was seen sometimes in the alleys off the harbour side or creeping around their shipyard out in the ragged isles. It was called the Aranya, and it took the form of a giant spider or sometimes a grasshopper, and it ticked, tick, 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 like a pocket watch. But that's all nonsense, said Fat Shago, waving away her words. Have you tasted the drink in those harbourside grog shops? Enough to make anyone see monsters. You must excuse my wife. She's a shipwright's daughter herself, and still sets store by these old superstitions. And then the goddess grew angry at the house of Thursday, just as everyone had said she would, said Signora Belkin, slapping her husband playfully on the wrist to punish him for interrupting her story. One night, she stirred the sea into a monstrous wave. It rushed over the ragged isles, smashing the Thursday's house and their shipyards, splintering the ships in their basins, washing away all the sheds and workshops, tearing down the mansion that Daniel Thursday had built on the shore there, and sucking the wreckage into the sea, along with him and all his family. All except his grandson, this boy Arlo, her husband said. All the rest of the family were swept away, all their servants and their workers too. Arlo was the only survivor. No wonder it turned him mad. Not mad, said his wife. It's just he lived alone out there on Thursday Island for a whole winter before they found him. Imagine that, said Signor Barcello. Months and months alone on that bleak rock with only the angels and the ghosts for company. Poor thing. It is little wonder that when he was finally rescued and brought back to the city, he was odd, to say the least, a recluse. He became an apprentice to Signora Belkin's father, old Augusto Blasi. But as soon as he reached manhood, he gave up shipbuilding and went to live all alone in the Thursday's old funicular on Casas Elevado. He makes little birds. Birds? Asked Laura Persimmon, thinking she had misheard him. Paper birds. Signor Barcello spread his hands out about 12 inches apart to show how big the things had been. It was as if, when the goddess took his family, Arlo turned his back on the sea and started dreaming of the sky instead. The white angels are forever flapping around that house of his, and these toy birds he makes used to be forever soaring over the city, though I haven't seen one for a while now. People used to say that he was planning to make one big enough that he could fly away on it.
Nonsense, said Fat Shago. Ridiculous.
Well, the ancients had flying machines, said Fever.
Fairy tales, protested Fat Shago, like your play. Neil Strongarm flying to the moon, a pretty story, but it never really happened. Surely a scientific young woman like yourself pays no heed to those old legends.
His wife agreed.
Only the Maya Bajo can make flying things, Senorita Crum, she said earnestly, fingering her brooch. It is not for us mortals. You must have heard the old saying, if the goddess had meant us to fly, she would have given us wings. It is small wonder that ill luck pursued our low Thursday.
Why would your sea goddess care what goes on in the air? Asked Fever.
She is not just the goddess of the sea, said Signor Barcello helpfully. Her symbol is the winged fish that swims both in the sea and the sky. Her home is the sea, and she has lived there since all things were water. But the whole world is hers. It is she who raised up the dry lands and lit the stars and made birds and beasts and people.
But, Fever started to say,
fascinating story, said A.P. hurriedly.
He didn't want Fever to offend these friendly Maidens with her outrageous ideas the same way she had Orca Mo.
It would make a good play, The Shipwright's Curse.
a pact with the devil, murders, secrets, a storm scene. I would play Daniel Thursday as a tragic hero, of course, with Mistress P as his long-suffering wife, trying to turn him back from the path of evil that he has chosen. Dimph, Fern, and Lilibet could all be mermaids. "What about me, AP?" called Cosmo lightly from the far end of the table. "Why, Cosmo," said Mistress Persimmon, raising her glass to him, "you would play the devil, of course." "And I'll be the demon spider," shouted Max Froy. "Tick, tick, tick!" Everyone laughed, and the talk veered back to plays. Fern tugged at Fever's coat cuff and said, "Fever, is there really a demon?" And Fever told her firmly that there were no such things except in stories and in the imaginations of stupid people. But she was barely listening. Her eyes had been drawn upward to the lamp-lit windows of the funiculars on the southern heights. She kept remembering the words the angel had croaked at her that first night on the cliffs. "Thursday, Thursday, try to fly." And the glider that had come to her on the night wind. It had been a signal. A sign. She felt certain of that. Fat Jargo wasn't the only Maiden who had heard that an engineer lived aboard the Lyceum. Clearly Arlo Thursday had heard it too, and he had followed her, and sent the glider to her to see if she could understand it. He wanted her to go to him. Perhaps he needed her help. Chapter 7. The Mysteries of Flight. That night, in her dreams, Fever flew. The shock of it half woke her, and she rolled over in her hammock, blaming the rich Maiden food. She almost never dreamed. She did not approve of dreaming. But then sleep took her again, and she was back in the sky. She was not flying in a balloon, like the clumsy thing that had lifted her clear from God's Hawk's head the day it burned. She flew like a bird, like an angel, arms stretched wide, fingers spread like flight feathers, soaring around the castles and cliffs of cloud that formed the base of a colossal thunderhead. Below her the sea burned with sunlight, gold and blue. She was so high that she could clearly see the blue arc of the horizon, and she thought to herself, "There! That proves that the earth is a sphere. That will show those superstitious people who claim it's flat." But somehow she could not hold on to the thought. It was swept away from her by the wild singing joy of flight as the wind tore past her and lifted her spiralling up and up and up again. She woke with a jolt and lay there tingling, feeling the vivid sensations of the dream slowly fade. A rim of grey light showed around the porthole shutter, but it was not yet day. When she took out the wax earplugs that she wore at night, she could hear Max Froy snoring in the neighbouring cabin, and beyond that, nothing. Only the silence of the theatre and the silence of the other barges around it, and around them, the wider silence of the sleeping city. Quiet as a ghost, she swung down out of the hammock, pulled off her nightshirt, and washed quickly in cold water from the pail she kept in the corner of the cabin. Then she dressed and put the model glider into a canvas shoulder bag and went with it out of her cabin and out of the barge into the clear, cool, empty morning. The sky above Maida was blue by then, but it would be some time yet before the sun rose high enough to peek above the crater rim. Sunk in lilac shadows and utterly still, the city looked like a picture painted by someone who was good at buildings but didn't do people. Not even the gulls, not even the angels were awake yet. She walked between the barges down to the harbour side with only the sounds of her footsteps for company. Dew had formed on the yards and rigging of the ships moored there. A thin cat appeared and ran soundlessly ahead of her as she went on along the quays, stepping over mooring cables and coils of tarred rope, writhing her way past old iron bollards and rusty winches. She found herself at the foot of the southern stair and started up them. The climb was long and steep, and the city was waking by the time she came to the street called Casas Elevado. It curved around the southern side of the crater several hundred feet above the harbour.
On the right-hand side, there was just a metal handrail and a dizzy view of the rooftops and chimneys of the houses below, from which smoke and smells of fresh-baked bread were beginning to rise. On the left, long stripes of garden stretched almost vertically up the crater wall. Up the length of each garden ran two pairs of metal rails, a house at the top of one, a blank-walled counterweight at the foot of the other. One of the counterweights had just started to move, rumbling slowly up the cliff while a house descended. Fever watched for a few seconds until she understood how they worked. Beneath their broad verandas, where an ordinary house might have a cellar, the funiculars had water tanks. When the occupants wished to descend, the tank was filled with water, pumped from reservoirs up among the crags. Then the funicular's own weight would pull it down the rails, dragging its counterweight up past it until the two had swapped places. When the house needed to go back up, it emptied its tanks while the tanks of the counterweight were filled, and the process was repeated. Some of the counterweights were little more than boxes on wheels, but most had been decorated to match their houses, and some were houses in their own rights. Fever was not sure how she was going to find the Thursday house, and there was nobody in that empty early morning street whom she could ask. But it turned out that she did not need to, for halfway along the street she passed a high wall, and then an ornate arched gateway, its portico carved with scenes of ships and dolphins, and the word Thursday in curly lettering. Fever pushed hopefully at the heavy gate, but it was locked. She put her face against the rusty railings and looked through into the garden. A turreted counterweight like an ornate tomb rested against its buffers in a grove of tall, dark trees. Following the rails up through the ragged foliage, Fever saw the house itself, a spiky, pointy-roofed construction perched at the top of its tracks.
"Go away!"
croaked a harsh voice from somewhere above her. She stepped back from the gate and looked up. An angel was perched on the top of the gateway. It flapped its wings and opened its beak to display a pointy grey tongue.
"Go away! No visitors!"
"I just want to talk to Señor Thursday," said Fever. The angel put its too big head on one side and studied her. Then, with a rattle of wings, it was gone. She looked through the gate again and saw it glide away between the trees and go soaring up the sunlit garden to vanish among the ramshackle spires of the house. It was the first angel she had met that had not asked her for snacks, and she wondered for a moment if it could be Arlo Thursday's gatekeeper, carrying a description of her to its master. But that was fanciful. The angels surely hadn't enough intelligence to be employed as servants. She was just turning away when a noise from the garden made her stop and look back. The counterweight was shifting. Creaks and clanks came from beneath it, then soft tearing sounds as it broke free of the weeds that had grown thickly around its wheels and chassis. Cables glinted and twanged taut between each pair of rails as the counterweight started to climb and the house started to descend. A wide, low house with broad verandas, dusty windows, that complicated roof of spires and turrets, all built from wood, gone grey with age and weather. It reached the bottom, clunking heavily into its resting place against the bottom set of buffers. For a moment there was silence. Then another sharp, mechanical noise, and the gate swung squeakily open. Wary, Fever stepped through into the garden. The gate swung shut behind her, and she heard bolts grating as they slid back into their holes, shutting her in. She tried to ignore her feelings of unease and concentrate instead on how that had been done. Not with water power, surely. There was old tech at work here. And she looked at the waiting house with fresh respect. No one came out to greet her. The door stayed shut, and no face showed behind the dusty windows. Feeling nervous, yet telling herself not to be so irrational, Fever went along the mossy path between the trees and stepped onto the veranda that ran all around the house. It did not rock or give beneath her weight, as she had half expected. It felt as firm as any ordinary house. Beneath the veranda, she could hear water gurgling and slopping into a drain as the ballast that had carried it down the cliffside emptied away. She knocked at the big front door. No one answered. Yet Fever had the feeling that she was being watched, and not just by the angels that perched on the roof.
"Signor Thursday," she called.
The wind stirred the trees. Angel claws scratched across the shingles. Fever was starting to grow impatient. Why would Arlo Thursday have brought his house down to street level and let her into his garden if he did not mean to talk with her? She walked around the house, following the sagging veranda. Across every window, pale, sun-faded blinds were drawn. At the back, the veranda was broader and covered by a wooden canopy, in the shade of which a white-painted wicker table and two matching chairs had been set out. From the canopy hung baskets of dry earth and dead flowers, and between them, twirling in the faint breeze, winged white shapes. Fever reached up and touched one, stilling it. The size of a small gull, it had been made with great care from paper and thin ribs of balsa wood. Its wings were bat-like, and there were four in all, two large ones mounted one above the other, two small ones, front and rear. Between them, lying flat, a child's doll had been mounted, its crude wooden hands outstretched as if to grip two small control levers. Something hard and cold jabbed against the flesh beneath Fever's right ear. She heard the creak and clack of a pistol being cocked, and a voice that said, "Turn around." She turned, not even breathing, just stretching her hands out slowly on either side of her to show that she was not armed. The pistol's muzzle wavered an inch from her face, a large bore pistol, long in the barrel, with an old-fashioned wheel-lock mechanism in which a slow match was clamped. The match dribbled a thin braid of blue smoke into the air. If the pistol's owner chose to pull the firing lever, the lit end of the match would be pressed into the tray of gunpowder in front of it, sparking an explosion which would drive a slug of lead through Fever's face. The closeness of the gun reminded her queasily of the time in London when the Skinner had cornered her, and Kit Solent had been forced to shoot him. It was difficult for her to look away from the weapon, but she controlled herself and looked and saw her captor. He was a young man, barefoot and dressed shabbily in clothes that had once been white. His face was mostly hidden by his hair, which was dark, tousled, and much too long. Fever could just see one greenish eye. "Who are you?" they both said at the same instant. "I've got the gun," said the stranger after a second more. "That means you have to go first."
"I'm Fever Crumb," said Fever.
"And who has sent you here, Fever Crumb? Was it Flynn? The Octopus Cartel? Or those clowns from Quadrada del Mar?" Fever, not knowing what either of those names meant, and wanting only for the pistol to be pointed somewhere else, said,
"I came here yesterday on a land barge, Persimmon's Ambulatory Lyceum. I'm looking for Arlo Thursday."
"Well, that's a new twist. A theatre." The green eye watched her unblinkingly for a long moment. Then the stranger lowered his pistol and took a step backward, shoving his hair away from his face with his free hand. His face was pleasant, and made more pleasant to Fever's eyes by the freckles that were scattered over it, dark against his sallow skin. They reminded her powerfully of the markings of her mother's people. For a shivery instant, she thought that he, too, was Scriven.
"You found me," he said. "I'm Thursday."
He was younger than Fever had expected. 20? 22? No older. He tilted his head quickly to one side and studied Fever. It was a movement she would have called bird-like, if that had not suggested fragility and hollow bones and a lightness not in keeping with his height and his broad shoulders.
"You don't look like an actress," he said.
"I operate the lights and stage effects," said Fever.
Arlo Thursday smiled.
"It's a long time since I saw a play. Perhaps you have brought me a free ticket. Is that why you climbed all the way up here, Fever Crumb?"
Fever sensed sarcasm in the question, but she wasn't good at sarcasm and had no idea how she should respond. "I'm not here on theatre business," she said. She opened a bag and pulled out the glider she had found on the cliff. "I've brought this back." Arlo Thursday's eyes went down to the model, then back up to Fever's face. There were shadows and questions in them, and something that looked a little like fear. He didn't sound at all sarcastic when he said, "How did you come by that?" "On the cliff path, the night before last," said Fever patiently. She knew it must have been Thursday himself who sent the model glider to her. She assumed that this was some sort of test. "It flew past me, landed in the bushes." Arlo Thursday watched her. There was something odd and secretive about him, his quick movements and the way he hid behind his hair. Suddenly he snatched the model from her and set it down on the table. This was an early version. It does not fly well.
"Well enough," said Fever. "It made me want to find out more."
"Ah," said Arlo Thursday. He looked up for a moment at the other miniature gliders swaying on their strings. He put down the gun, then reached up and unhooked the largest of the models, a boxy thing with four wings.
"Weasel!"
he called. His voice echoed against the cliffs, and before the echo faded, there was a fluttering of wings, and an angel landed on the veranda, tilting its head, its blue eyes glinting greedily.
"Snaxes?"
it croaked. Arlo Thursday did not answer, unless that odd little quirk of his head was an answer. He was moving some part of the model that he held in his hands, winding and winding a carved shape like a double-ended spoon that was set in the centre of it. After a few seconds he walked to the edge of the veranda, held the machine above his head, and threw it as far and as hard as he could.
"No!"
gasped Fever, afraid that the beautiful thing would be snatched by the rising wind and dashed to pieces against the rocks of the garden. But instead of falling, the model rushed busily upward, its paper wings dazzling white in the sunlight, the spoon thing churring as it whirled, a paddle wheel, a propeller. When it was almost out of sight, way up in the sky above the crater, it lost momentum and began to spiral downward, but the angel called Weasel kicked into the sky with one big beat of his scruffy wings, soared easily after it, and snatched it in his beak. Another wing beat carried him back to the veranda, where Arlo took the model from him and laid it down carefully on the table. He sat down on one of the wicker chairs, or rather he perched on it, pulling his knees up to his chin and wrapping his bare toes around the edge of the seat. "It's just a model, but if it were built full size, with an engine, a lightweight engine, then a person could ride on it. He could fly." He looked at her, daring her to disagree. She said, "Dr. Collihall thought that it was impossible. He's an engineer I know in London. He says that if we are ever to fly, then we must concentrate on making balloons. I went up in the balloon he built."
"Gas or hot air?"
asked Arlo, as if balloons were commonplace things.
"Hot air. There was a brazier on board."
"How far did you fly?" Fever wasn't sure. She had been terrified and exhausted, and she had slept through most of that historic flight.
"It must have travelled 20 miles.
Arlo Thursday bobbed his head like a pigeon. "Balloons are no use. Clumsy. Easy to get up, but hard to steer, and impossible to bring down where you want them. They make you a slave to the wind."
"Heavier than air is the answer. Aeroplanes. Like the ancients used."
Fever nodded eagerly, to show that she, too, knew something about the ancients.
"Dr. Collihall studied one. Well, the remains of one. It wasn't much more than a stain in the earth, but you could see how big it had been, and the shape, like a giant bird. But he could never understand how they got the wings to flap."
"They don't need to." Arlo Thursday peeked at her through his overgrown hair. She had the feeling that he didn't really want to talk to her, but couldn't stop himself. He said, "When I was a boy, I used to watch the angels and long to fly like they did. Look at them." He pointed out into the sky, where dozens of the grubby creatures wheeled, keeping watch for dropped snacks in the streets below. "They hardly move their wings at all. You saw Weasel just now. He flapped once or twice to lift himself, again to change direction. But most of it was just gliding. That's the way I made my first models. The angels were happy enough to let me draw and measure them. They aren't quite as bird-brained as most people think. I learned everything from them." Fever picked up the model aircraft. She turned it in her hands, running her fingers over the leading edges of the wings, feeling the roundness there, the way they tapered. There was something about that shape that must help the machine rise and keep it in the air. What about the engine? Could you make one light enough for the machine to carry?
Arlo Thursday shrugged. I know nothing about engines. I'm Maiden. We don't have them here, except for a couple of weeks each year when you travelling folk bring your barges over. But I had a friend in Thelona, a man called Edgar Saraband. He wrote to me about flying machines. I made some models for him, some designs. He was clever with engines. He thought he could build one small enough to fly with.
Did he succeed?
Yes. From what I've heard, his machine flew. But then... He paused. Fever waited for more, but no more came. She dimly remembered that name, Saraband. Remembered AP flapping his newspaper at her somewhere in the Rust Country, sometime early in the summer, saying,
"Here, Fever, this will interest you. 'Tis most scientific."
There had been a story about a rich Thelonan who had built a flying machine, only it had not so much flown as fallen. She had paid no attention at the time. Newspapers were full of stories like that. "Are you planning to make a full-scale machine?" she asked. Thursday's face changed. It was as if blinds had been lowered behind his eyes.
"No,"
he said. "Why not?"
"Too dangerous."
"Edgar Saraband didn't think so."
"Edgar Saraband is dead."
He stood up, still holding the pistol. He didn't point it at Fever, just let it hang there by his side, while he said,
"You're leaving now."
"But there are so many things I want to ask you."
"Well, you can't. I'm tired. Or busy, or something."
He followed Fever back around the veranda. Angels who had gathered along the eaves burst into the sky with clattering wing beats.
Arlo Thursday said, "I want you to promise me something, Fever Crumb. You'll not speak of me to anyone."
"Very well," said Fever meekly. "But you should try to make a full-size machine. I could help you. I know a bit about engines."
"No," said Arlo Thursday.
"But you must need my help. Why else would you have sent the glider to me?"
"I didn't."
"Then who?"
"I don't know," he said. "I've lost models before. Crosswinds catch them, up among those crags. Maybe some kid found it. Thanks for returning it. Goodbye."
Fever went back along the path to the gate. Halfway there, she stopped and looked back, and Arlo Thursday was no longer watching her. But just before she reached the gate, the lock clacked and it swung open to let her out onto Casas Elevado. It closed again, as before, when she had stepped through. From behind her, she heard the house give a long sigh, and then the squeak and rumble of its wheels as it climbed away from her. Chapter 8. The Secret Pool. As soon as she had gone, Arlo Thursday went back inside his house and operated the levers that opened valves high above, filling the tanks of the counterweight. As the building began its long climb, he went through the big front room, squeezing his way past the thing that filled it, and looked out of the window to see if he could see Fever Crumb. He could not.
How stupid he had been to let her in. He should have kept the house up high and the gate locked, but when Weasel had come flying to tell him that there was a visitor, he hadn't been able to resist the temptation to talk to someone, especially when he looked through his telescope and saw her waiting there, not that busybody Flynn, or some thug from the local branch of the Octopus Cartel, but a pretty girl. He felt embarrassed now that her prettiness had influenced him. Was he that shallow? And when he'd seen her close up, she had just reminded him how much he was in love with someone else. Still, she had seemed a sweet girl, and she had seemed honest. She hadn't shown a flicker of recognition when he mentioned poor Edgar Saraband, and yet... her glider. Was it a message? He went out onto the veranda again, and picked it up from the table. He had often lost models among the crags, as he had told Fever Crumb, but this was not one of them. This was a model he had made for Edgar Saraband, and sent to Saraband's workshop in Thelona. How had it found its way back to Maida, and into the hands of that girl? When the house reached the top of its rails, he set the brakes and stepped down into the garden,
squinting in the sunshine and the brisk, dusty breeze that blew his hair across his face. His angels wheeled about the house. He called Weasel down to him and held out his arm so that the angel could perch on his wrist. "Follow the girl," he told him. He did not say it with words, but with squawks and clicks and quick movements of his head, the language of angels. "Watch all that she does."